You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
I am Eric Von Zipper, and I come here to tell you that these beach bums is bum.
This is Studio 360 from WNYC in New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I'm not in the studio at all. I'm out at the beach on Coney Island. Actually, the whole show today is on the beach.
Lots of sand, lots of water, not just damp sand, but like soupy sand.
We came out here to feel the sand between our toes, to hear the surf, and watch all these greasy, half-naked people lounge around the beach.
We can see 20, 30, who knows how many, just many, many mermaids.
I'll be the only boy in my block that knows a real live mermaid.
In a little while, John Flansburg and John Linnell will join me out here. They are the two brilliant musicians who make up one of my favorite bands, They Might Be Giants. That is all ahead in Studio 360, where art and real life collide. Before we talk to They Might Be Giants and hear them play their special custom-composed Studio 360 beach show songs, we're going to take a look at design for the real world right here on the sands of Coney Island. Stephen Heller is with me today under the umbrella. Steve Heller is a designer and critic and a frequent contributor to Design for the Real World. Welcome to the beach, Stephen.
Hi, Kurt. Great to be here.
So there's a big, beautiful beach here with stone jetties and big piers and children digging and gambling across the sands. But when Coney Island was really built 100 or more years ago, it was something grander and special and singular, wasn't it?
Coney Island was the fantasy world. It was built on the model of the World's Fairs, which were the fairs that projected the future. The parachute jump is the Eiffel Tower of Coney Island. It was originally built for the 39 World's Fair, for the Lifesaver Company, and it was in their entertainment zone. Entertainment was the place, was the thing that people wanted out of these fairs. So essentially what the Coney Island people did was they brought the most popular attraction to the beach.
So how does that work? I mean, you mentioned that it looked like the Eiffel Tower. It does. If the Eiffel Tower were sort of peeled down like a banana a bit, when that's working again, how will it work?
What happens is there are cables connected to these to the top of it, which flouts out, and people get on the parachutes on a seat. They're pulled up. Would make me very sick. And then once you reach the top, guess what? Dropped. And if all things work well, you float down to the bottom.
What's interesting is that today we have in modern resorts the kind of latter-day version of that, which are the parasail rides and the sort of parachutes where you're pulled along by motorboats. Where they're, here there's something really monumental and architectural that isn't going anywhere.
This was monumental, and it was exactly as you say. This was the next step after New York City. The great skyscrapers of New York City were rising higher and higher as Coney Island used that technology and brought it out to this here suburb.
So in its kind of leisure fantasy way, this was like a mirror image of the city that was rising 10 miles away.
It was the skeleton of the city, really. You know, it's all based in that turn-of-the-century Victorian Art Nouveau sensibility that leads into the Industrial Age aesthetic that then goes into the Mechanical Age. All of that stuff is here, and this is a real wellspring for design as physical entity and as a kind of mythology.
So unlike Disney World, with its pseudo turn-of-the-century Main Street, the real thing is right here.
This is the real thing. You don't need to go to Disney World, Disneyland, or any of the other lands. Coney Island is it.
Stephen Heller, thank you very much.
Thanks, Kurt.
Stephen Heller is the author of several thousand design books, which you couldn't hope to read if you spent all summer reading them.
You're my Coney Island baby. It means so much to me. You're my pretty little lady. I love you tenderly. You're my Coney Island.
I'm Kurt Anderson. I like being here. I like the beach fine. I like looking out at the surf come in and the gulls play on the rocks and the children run in and out of the surf and all the rest of it, but I am not one of those people who needs the beach like a pilgrim. That might be because I grew up as far away from beaches as an American can in Nebraska. So my experience of sand meeting sea was mostly through art, especially through entertainment, like the movies of my youth. Bikini Beach and Beach Party and Beach Blanket Bingo, all of them starring Frankie Avalon and Annette Funicello, and all of them almost surreally horrible. And I also experienced the beach as a kid in Nebraska through songs, not just of the Beach Boys, but songs like Wipeout by the Surfaris and Pipeline by the Ventures. But when I finally saw the real thing, the beach didn't resemble that sun-blasted Hollywood dreamscape at all. For starters, it was in Maine, not Malibu. I was 8 years old, and everything, the sky, the water, the stones that covered the ground, everything was gray. But that first beach experience was also magical. I sat alone on a rock at low tide, playing with a strand of seaweed and thinking my 8-year-old thoughts, and suddenly there was a beautiful young woman sitting a few feet away from me, talking to me. She smiled and seemed to glow and spoke with an accent. She told me she was from Iceland. We chatted a while, and today, for the life of me, I just can't recall how this encounter ended. And so in my memory, it's kind of a fleeting, fragmentary fairy tale, sort of like the Daryl Hannah movie Splash crossed with Ingmar Bergman's Seventh Seal. As far as I'm concerned, the beach, even on sunny days, tends to have a bit of the melancholy about it. For me, the aesthetics of the beach, the bottomless sea, the relentless waves and wind, the minimalism of the lines and the materials here, evoke death more than life. In fact, I remember the second time I was alone on a beach in Mexico, summer I turned 15, I was carried out into the Pacific by a riptide, and I'm certain nearly killed. 20 years ago, when I first visited the remarkable beach town of Seaside on Florida's Gulf Coast, I finally got it, finally grokked the civilized, relaxed, communal, small-scale joys of beach culture. I understood that everybody goes to the beach to experience some kind of good old days, whether they're based on pictures or stories or songs or actual childhood memories. People want good old days of some kind, good old days that may or may not have ever actually existed. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we have brought Studio 360 to Coney Island. My guests today are John Flansburgh and John Linnell. In other words, the wonderful band They Might Be Giants. They have been playing together for more than 20 years, and on the Studio 360 boombox here on the beach today, I've got what is now surely their best known song.
Wow, that's loud.
Cool,
it's
man,
it's appropriate.
And that's, of course, is You're Not the Boss of Me, which is the theme song for Malcolm in the Middle. Both of you live in Brooklyn?
Yes.
That's right.
And here we are in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Yes.
Are you guys regular Coney Island habitués?
Yeah, I came here last year to go to the Coney Island Museum, which is a whole other kind of cultural center, but that's a real nighttime freak show rather than the daytime Coney Island boardwalk freak show. But Coney Island is so different than a lot of other
freak shows.
Beach places, you know, it's very it's very bluesy in a way.
I've come here in the wintertime, and it's a really rarefied scene here then, because most everything is shut, but it's got a real vibe, you know. And also, you know, we take our kid to the aquarium down here. That's usually the reason for coming.
People talk at all kinds of beaches and all kinds of islands about, oh, winter is the time to be there. To me, I mean, as I've revealed my sense of the sort of imminence of death on beaches anyway.
Yeah, right.
Winter, it really just seems like...
It's a dark scene.
Yeah.
It's very...
Winter in Maine, it really gets you to the, you know, the Katharine Hepburn in your soul.
Right.
But I don't know. I mean, we're East Coast people and, you know, we're not player haters. We, you know, we love the West Coast and everything. But there is something very, very seasonal about the life on the beach on the East Coast. And I think, you know, loving the beach as a New Englander is like, it's not that different than being a Red Sox fan or something. You know, ultimately, it's gonna go terribly wrong come September.
You obviously work hard. You tour a lot. You make music. You have now made this new film, Gigantic, the documentary celebrating yourselves and your lives. In Gigantic, this film, among other things, it depicts you as being really nice to fans. Is that just because you're nice guys, or
we're not particularly nice to fans? I mean, I think there's like sort
so
of
those
like
are
a,
the fake scenes, I guess.
Those well, were staged. Yeah.
We're respectful of fans. I think we're respectful of the idea of the of an audience in the abstract, which I think is a much more recessive trait in performers. I like to think that like there's a good chance that there's somebody out there who's like in the audience who's like as smart or probably smarter than we are. You know, so. You know, we kind of regulate our behavior by that. But in terms of, like, doing the sort of country music, like, shake hands and, like, you know...
Pose.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's we shake hands and pose, but we don't... But beyond that, it's like we don't really pretend to be anybody's
yeah,
friend.
It's, I guess it's such an artificial experience. And the only time we get to talk to people who are fans are in this really weird, overheated environment.
There's also a wonderful moment in the film, a piece of tape from when you were playing on The Tonight Show... with Doc Severinsen.
Right.
Was that just sort of goofy and wonderful to
It was very exciting.
It was utterly nerve-wracking. At the time, it seemed like a disaster, and seeing the clip in AJ's movie was a big surprise, because my memory was that we had completely screwed it up. We played the thing really fast, and it just seemed like the most nerve-wracking experience of our lives. And we looked very comfortable on the screen for some reason.
And, of course, in that instance, you played with the whole brass section, and I'm very happy to report that you've brought a big brass section today.
Yes, including Mark Pender from The Conan Show. So that'll be cool.
Let's head over to the Coney Island Museum, where your band is. And we get to walk toward this amazing vista of new and old and kind of crappy and wonderful Astroland rocket ships and a... great Ferris wheel. It's
Wonder Wheel. But the Cyclone is no longer with us, is it?
No, that's the Cyclone right there.
That wooden roller coaster.
Which is so dwarfed by modern, gigantic Six Flags style roller coaster.
Yeah.
But much more terrifying if you've ridden it, because
it's much more dangerous.
Because it's made out of wood, it makes way more racket, and you have a real sense that you could very easily die.
Yeah.
See, but this—it seems to me now that it is not as decrepit as it was a few years ago. It's right at a good level of ramshackleness,
right?
Not too slick, but not too depressingly messed up.
Well, Coney Island and Asbury Park and all these other kind of East Coast places—they're always getting the like, "Oh, it's coming back," and you never know what to think. You know, is it really going to come back?
Was it ever there?
Right.
It's like big bands are always coming back.
Right. You never really known it when it was.
There it was officially okay. Apparently, I mean, when it started, it was considered this incredibly disreputable place because originally it was where sailors came to visit prostitutes, I guess, and I don't know what else. But
and
it was
for the record, I see no sailors or prostitutes.
Yeah, they've moved on.
No. All right, we're entering the very narrow and steep hallway up the stairs to the Coney Island Museum here in Brooklyn. Hey, fellas. We're in the main room of the Coney Island Museum where all the shows happen, the burlesque shows and everything else.
But we can still, out the window here, see the Cyclone roller coaster beyond.
Yes.
And if you really stand on your tiptoes, I think even see the edge of the ocean.
But keeping with the feeling of modern-day Brooklyn, they've made sure that the windows actually do not open on this 90-degree day.
There's enough equipment here for a symphony orchestra, and I guess you guys should plug it in and tune it up and
see
get ready
works.
To go.
Yeah. The They Might Be Giants Tiny Symphony is about to begin.
Okay, so are we ready? Are we ready now? Shall we record it?
What are we going to hear first?
This first song is entitled Idlewild, and it's kind of a dream of a perfect day in New York City sometime in the past.
It's all yours.
Sideshow at Steeplechase Bar. Test your strength, guess your weight. La la la. La la la. La la la. La la la. Take a trip in a sky ride.
Is They Might Be Giants. John Linnell, John Flansburg, and your magnificent band, whom you will introduce to us.
Well, that's Nathan Durham on the tuba, Mr. Dan the Machine Levine on the trombone, Mark the Love Man Pender on the
that's right.
trumpet, and
you hear the police sirens just as you introduce
right.
Mark.
Right. Car 54, where is he? And of course, Marty Beller on the drums, on the tiny drums. Thank you, Marty.
I'm Kurt Anderson here with They Might Be Giants. In a minute, we'll meet a guy who makes sandcastles that are truly awesome. So stay with us. This is Studio 360, very near the sand and the beach. It's from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson with Studio 360, and we are hanging out at the beach for a day. I'm at Coney Island, fortunately and happily, with John Flansburg and John Linnell of the band They Might Be Giants. We are going to hear some more music from They Might Be Giants in a few minutes, but first we're going to listen to a story from a beach 3,000 miles due west of here, where we found the king of sandcastles. Kirk Rademacher is a sand sculptor, which means he makes serious architecture out of sand with arches and balconies, fantastical structures as high as 10 feet tall with sloping curves that stretch all over the beach. He showed off his skills for us at Ocean Beach in San Francisco.
Sand sculpture is great. It's like sketching in 3D. You can get an image really quickly. You can quickly put up a large block of sand. I use these cylindrical forms here, two of them here. I pack the sand inside of them. Lots of sand, lots of water, not just damp sand, but like soupy sand. The water drains out. Here, get a little more sand in there. There's plenty of it out here. It's for free. you're out here on the beach where everything's temporary. People walk differently on the beach, and they're not going anywhere. They're just there, you know, for that moment. And so the art that you make here on the beach is the same thing. It's just here, and then it's gone. Here. Little balcony. It's like I'm a little kid here again, making my own fort. My own little fantasy world here. Oh, here, make some little stairs. They're coming up through down to that arch there. I was used to art being a solitary endeavor, you know. I came to the beach to do this. Hi there.
I like your sandcastle.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's like a sociable art form. You know, I come out here, and it's like traveling. I meet people, I talk to people, and that's part of it.
You want to get another one going on the side of here?
Yeah. This is cool. Go
right here. They're cutting stale mashed potatoes. You guys playing your food?
Yeah.
You do?
Sometimes. Sometimes. I'm making the road.
They have a wall here that's maybe an inch and a half thick. I want to see air. I want to see a space through it.
Okay, wait.
Just like a kid, you know, they always want to dig a tunnel, you know.
You want to make a hole in here?
Yeah, from one side to the other. That's all I'm doing here. It's going all the way through. I love doing that.
What do you do this? Okay, if anyone makes this thing break, it's not really their fault. We'll just have to refill it.
It's a combination of all of my favorite things. You know, it's people, it's nature, and it's art. It's all rolled into one. It's the perfect art gallery.
The sand sculptor Kirk Rademacher on Ocean Beach in San Francisco. You can see pictures of some of his work at studio360.org. Jonathan Mitchell produced our story, and I'm Kurt Anderson at Coney Island today with John Flansburgh and John Linnell of They Might Be Giants.
Yo, yo, yo.
What do you think of an artist who basically just does this childhood thing as his art? Is that
What are you trying to say with that question?
Well, can you imagine doing it, or do you feel as though you're doing it?
I think if you're in a rock band, it's pretty much a Peter Pan existence.
Well, except I mean the one kind of interesting difference is, like, we actually get to do this thing for posterity. You know, I think it was actually Sarah Vowell who said, "You guys, in a way, are kind of cheating death with this." And the thing, obviously, with the sandcastle guy is, it's gone, you know. It's a much more intense commitment on his part to do something that is just going away.
Although, as he suggests, in the end, it all goes away.
Right, exactly. And there's a lot of, you know, I guess it's, there's a lot of joy in that, you know. I feel like, I mean, we do a lot of stuff that is just kind of, you know, broadcasting. It's just in the air, and then it's over. I mean, in some ways, I feel like live shows are essentially the musical equivalent of sandcastles. You know, they can be impressive and they can be really good, but they're really over when they're done.
Well, and what he said about the way people, I think, regard, you know, cool sculptures and alligators and fish and castles on the beach is really true. They have time. They're not going anywhere, so they spend more time looking at those and admiring those than when they're in the Museum of Modern Art and looking at the piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's absolutely a fantastic way to see something.
Well, and speaking of children's things, your last record was at least ostensibly, a children's record, but it seems as great and funny and interesting and cool to me as any of your supposedly adult records.
Yeah, well, yeah. A friend of ours pointed out, you know, I mean, I said something to that effect to her, and she said, "Oh, so you haven't actually lowered your standards for children, considering?"
But yeah, it's pretty much follows in the sort of, you know, psychedelic legacy of They Might Be Giants work. You know, we felt like it was very important that it really work as a creative record, you know, for kids.
Baby just, psychedelics, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yes. Well, I mean, you know, there's some. I mean, it's to just to be part of a kid's childhood is like a huge honor. You know, you're really presenting them with some of the first stuff that they're going to ever think about. So it's in some ways it's a much bigger responsibility than, you know, just making a regular rock record.
And developing future audiences forever and ever.
Well, that was the secret reason.
Yeah. Yeah. That was our manager's reason.
I think it's time for another song. What's
okay.
this one called?
Well, this one is also about the beach. It's actually about, it's based on a book about finding buried treasure in Casco Bay, Maine, written by a complete crackpot, and he uses a metal detector. And so this song is based on that.
Let's hear it.
Down at the shore, there's a place where there's no one vacationing. There's just the sound of the call of the wild, overcoming the fear of the unknown. And I've got something to help you understand, something waiting there beneath the sand. My metal detector is with me all of the time. I'm the inspector over the mine. Look past the squawking gull. Look past the volleyball. Ignore the mountain of discarded boulder all. 'Cause I've got something to help you understand. Something waiting there beneath the land. My metal detector is with me all of the time. I'm the inspector over the mine. Metal detector, watch it shine. Every seashell has a story to tell if you're listening. And underneath every shell there's a story. If you've heard enough of the sea, then everything on the top will just suddenly stop seeming interesting. So listen now to the sound of the things that are found underground. Understand something waiting there beneath the sand. My metal detector is with me all of the time. I'm the inspector over the mine. Look past the squawking gull. Look past the volleyball. Ignore the mountain of discarded boulder all. 'Cause I've got something to help you understand. Something waiting there beneath the sand. My metal detector is with me all of the time. I'm the inspector over the mine.
They might be giants, John Linnell and John Flansburgh, playing the song Metal Detector, which speaks to my childhood. I didn't have a metal detector, but just for the lack of the dollars, I had a giant thing called a big ear that allowed me to listen to other people's conversations.
Oh, man. So, see, I didn't even have one of those.
Yeah, no, I was that kind of obsessive nerd that song is about, I think. That reminds me of a lot of your music in the way that it's, on one level, it's sort of fun and bouncy, but if as you listen closely, it is there's a worm in the apple. Is that fair?
You know, I think it's not that's not the specific plan, but that often is what we wind up with. You know, I think we write lyrics based on an idea, and we write the music based on kind of more of a mood. You know, and they often are not strictly linked. You know, so the effect of the music and the words is, you know, they're kind of running in slightly different directions.
But that's a effect of your process, but obviously it's deliberate over time, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, I think at our best, there's always a certain element of compressed thought in the lyric writing, and I think by its nature, it's inviting to, you know, people who want to examine it. But you know, it's a real, you know, writing a good song is a very strange balancing act. It's a really weird kind of confection. You know, you don't know what part is going to be enough to, like, leave all the other considerations alone. And sometimes, you know, really, I mean, basically a simple idea is often the best one.
And this literally begins with the idea of this sort of dedicated, determined, maybe obsessive guy alone on a beach with his metal detector?
Well, there's this, like I said, there's this particular book which was written by somebody who must be out of his mind, because it was written for a vanity press, and he describes how to look for buried treasure in this very specific part of Maine.
Not known for its treasure?
Not particularly. And he's just describing, he's basically just talking about his own experience, you know. And for some reason, he's written it as a book for others who may want to follow in exactly the footsteps he has laid down.
But what began as a Vanity Press book is now a pop hit. You know, so I guess it's, you know,
I don't know. I feel like we're closer to that guy than right. we are to the pop hit. Right.
The next story we're going to listen to is about the darker side of the beach too, but it's sort of sexy. Paul Delvaux was a painter who painted his beach fantasy in 1942. It's called Village of the Mermaids. The foreground tells one story, but in the distance there's another story, a surprise. Judith Kempfner went into the vaults of the Art Institute of Chicago to see Delvaux's painting, along with curator Stephanie D'Alessandro.
The painting is actually based on a dream that Delvaux had, an image that haunted him, and in a way, this is an image that haunted you.
This Art Institute did a very unusual thing. It wrote to the painter and said, "Oi, what's this all about?"
Yeah. And Delvaux, surprisingly, wrote us back a 2-page letter and explained exactly what the village was, exactly what the title was, exactly who those women were, and told us the whole story of the origin of the painting.
May 17, 1956. Dear Sir, I have received your kind letter of May 7th. I will try to give you the information you ask for on the subject of the Village of the Mermaids. I was inspired for the subject by a dream. In a strange street, there was a succession of closed doors. In front of each door, seated on a chair in the faked style of Louis XVI, in gilded wood, sits a woman dressed in a long robe with a high collar. The woman sits absolutely motionless, with her hands on her knees like a doorkeeper. Each woman wears a robe of different color. Each has long hair of different color, blonde or brown, and each chair is different from the other. The street extends far into the background and leads to a beach which is surrounded by white mountains.
Immediately, the street starts to fall forward and then to the right. On the left-hand side, there's five women. Every single one of them is sitting in a high-backed sort of ornamental chair. I think that something else that I would probably look at that would help me to sort of figure out what's going on is there's a man fully dressed. He has a hat on, a coat, top coat, and he's walking away from these women. And on his left side is a very tall wall. And on the other side of this wall, we can see 20, 30, who knows how many. To me, there's a sense of just many, many mermaids coming from a beach and going out into the water. There's a few that are sort of out there already. And it's just a completely mysterious, enchanting image.
What is going on here? The women in their long robes and long hair, who were sitting in front of their doors just a moment ago, are transported to the beach and freed from their robes and are suddenly revealed as beautiful mermaids who are plunging into the waves where they disappear for good.
I think that he gets at that in the way that that deep perspective pulls us through to the next part of his dream, which is from those women in dresses to those mermaids. He got at it by the way that he created that depth and that roll of the street through the village.
I guess the eroticism of it is the contrast between the clothed women and the naked mermaids, well, half-naked mermaids. They've sort of got low-slung tails. Mm-hmm. The eroticism may be also in the quantity of women outnumbering this poor little man.
Mm-hmm. I think also part of the eroticism is in the secret that's just tantalizingly on the other side of the wall. Rugged mountains, unsculptured, untamed, uncivilized beach scene, and women in their true reality. This beach, it's glistening. It's bright. The water's clear. The mountains and the sand are very brightly illuminated. There's a wonderful sense of freedom, of liberation, of peace. To say joy is maybe too much, but there's a wonderful hope and peacefulness in that scene, that beach scene that's just in the distance.
All this is found in the picture, and yet I was hoping to preserve the complete mystery. The big women with their long hair have moved towards the beach and, dropping their long robes, are plunging into the water, which is green and transparent, and then that's all. The beach is deserted, and so is the street with the closed doors. Here, then, are some notes, a charming story which I have attempted to put into a painting as a composer might try to put to music a lovely poem. Sincerely, Paul Delvaux.
For Studio 360, I'm Judith Kampfner.
You can see Paul Delvaux's Village of the Mermaids online at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson with the band They Might Be Giants out at Coney Island today, listening to songs and stories about the beach. John, you were looking at a reproduction of this picture right now. The whole description of it and the picture itself certainly is not what we Americans in our kind of Frankie and Annette way think of as the beach, is it?
No, it seems like it's a terrific summary of 20th century surrealism to me. I mean, it has all the sort of psychological touchstones of the movement.
Are mermaids an appealing idea to you? I mean, we're here in the Coney Island Museum in Coney Island. There's a big mermaid tradition as part of the
mythology. That's to me is completely weird. I mean, the whole idea of mermaids as erotic is really weird. I think because they don't apparently have,
well, to second base.
You can get to second base. Yeah, yeah.
But then, we're talking about second base on PRI.
That's right. But that's where it ends, pretty much.
Well, I feel like I really don't understand the unknowable aspect of the mermaid and its mythology.
Although Daryl Hannah in Splash.
Yeah, where does that come from?
I don't know. Well, I mean, it comes from being out on the sea for months and years at a time in the 19th century, I suppose. And, you know, your hopes about a fish and your sadness about it.
I get it. Yeah, yeah. No, that's good.
What you've left.
I like where you're going.
Well, it also strikes me...
That fish is looking nice.
Exactly. And I'm not just talking fish sticks either.
Right.
That fish is lonely, like me. Finally, someone who understands me.
John Flansburgh and John Linnell, They Might Be Giants. They're my guests today, and we'll hear them play again in just a minute. I'm Kurt Anderson at Coney Island. In a minute, we'll look at Capiz, Art on the Half Shell. That's ahead here on the beach with Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson with John Linnell and John Flansburgh, otherwise known as the band They Might Be Giants. We are at the beach today, or at least in a stifling room very, very close to the beach, the Coney Island Museum here on Surf Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. And we've come indoors so we don't get, I guess, sand in the tuba.
Or sunburned or any of that.
You have another song for us.
Yes.
What is it?
This is off the Beach Boys album Pet Sounds, and it's called Caroline No.
So this is by the Beach Boys.
This is by Brian Wilson with the Beach Boys.
Yes. Let's hear it.
Where did your long hair go? Where is the girl I used to know? How could you lose that happy glow? Oh, Caroline, no. Who took that look away? I remember how you used to say you'd never change, but that's not true. That made me love you so much then. Could we ever get them back once they had gone? Oh, Caroline.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. That was John Flansburgh singing, I guess, the Brian Wilson part.
Yeah, we were talking about that. Actually, we're wondering if it's Carl Wilson or Brian Wilson because they both have similar voices. Sometimes Carl does the sort of...
Carl sings the hard ones, I think.
Yeah.
And that was John Linnell playing the accordion.
That's right.
Tune.
Yeah, which I think Brian played the accordion on the original.
Which one of you is the Brian Wilson of They Might Be Giants?
Oh.
I think I'm the Dennis. And
yeah. Yeah,
John,
I do a pretty good Mike Love when when it really gets down to it. But I don't know. I can't imagine what it's like to work with somebody like Brian Wilson. You know, when people talk about that circumstance, you know, I can't imagine. You know, we have such a practical kind of rolling down the highway sort of relationship and work experience. You know, I mean, it seems like
there's none of the he's the genius nut visionary keep away from him.
There's any, I've got a vision. Everyone, shut up.
No, we work the nut angle pretty well all around. You know, that definitely serves. You know, you look, at a certain point, you realize that kind of thing will be rewarded if you know it keeps people at arm's length.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson at Coney Island with They Might Be Giants. Do either of you guys make a habit of picking up stuff along the beach as you're walking around?
Yeah, actually, I have to say, last time I was at the beach, we collected stones and went home and made some mobiles for our house out of stones gathered on the beach.
Really? How do you hook the stone onto a wire?
You know, my wife has got some jewelry making equipment, and we made some Calder-esque things with some driftwood and stones, and they're in our bathroom, and they look very inappropriate, but they're full of spirit.
And if I see them on eBay, I'll know where they came from. Well, we're going to hear a story now from a place where seashells are more than souvenirs, and where they're indeed Calder-like works of art, I guess. They are part of the economy there and serious art. Jocelyn Gonzalez explains the history and craft of kapis, which is a traditional Philippine art form.
For you, the sound of the sea might be this. But for me, it's this. These are kapis shells. When I was growing up, one reminder of the islands my family left behind were chandeliers made of hundreds of nearly transparent, iridescent clam shells. They seemed to float in our old rooms with an otherworldly light, like sunshine diffused by waves of water. Kapis is from the Pakuna shell, and it's found in the Philippine waters off the southern island of Panay. Every 7 years, the clams come to the end of their natural life cycle, and millions of the shells wash up on the shores at low tide. While the fishermen sell off the meat as a delicacy, the shells are sold to artisans.
So out of that, they would make jewelries, decorations, and window frames.
Esther Andaya remembers Kapi's artwork from her childhood in the Philippines, where the shells were first used by the Spaniards in the 16th century.
You see them a lot in the churches. This one's for, you know, vestibules, decorations inside. Filipino churches, that is, not the foreign ones.
Because these early craftsmen didn't have stone and stained glass, early Filipino churches employed native wood carving and kapis window panes. The shells were even used in mosaic and religious sculpture. From that point, kapis got handed down as a decorative element in traditional Filipino homes. The massive red kapis chandeliers in Esther's New Jersey living room are over 20 years old, and they were given to her by her mother.
Oh, it reminds me of those mansions, the beautiful houses in the Philippines that the rich people have. They are the only ones who can afford them at that time. They are expensive. They are handmade, and those shells are too thin and too delicate to work with. They have to sew them one by one. They used nylon threads for that.
I wondered if anyone in the U.S. worked with these shells, besides the importers selling mass-produced souvenirs over the internet. I found Gwen Carlton, a designer who decided to try making these intricate fixtures herself.
Well, you know, I used to have a mid-century furniture store a couple of years ago, and I had one of the original Filipino chandeliers hanging in the store. I had dozens of people want to buy it from me. I just kind of looked at it and thought, well, it's whatever this material is in filament. I mean, I could make that. It was actually kind of hard to find out that much about the shells. It took, you know, kind of a few months even to find out where I could get them. I just sort of got into some books, and I knew that Werner Panton had made some... They called it the Fun Series in the 60s, where he had used the kapis shells. So I was familiar with it from there.
Gwen holds a U.S. Fish and Wildlife import-export license to get the shells from the Philippines. After they're harvested, the round 3-inch shells are soaked overnight in water and a mild acid to clean and soften them. Then they're scraped, polished, and cut. Although they're sometimes dyed or glazed, Gwen uses kapis in their natural shades.
You know, they actually don't really look like shells, I don't think. I think they probably look more like very thin discs of glass, you know. And, you know, individually they're pretty nondescript, but when you get lots and lots of them together, they start having a real sculptural quality to them.
Gwen wanted a very lush presentation of kapis, so she uses up to 4 or 5 times the amount of shells, perhaps up to 12,000, all hand-knotted with simple fishing line. It can take days or weeks to make one custom fixture. She calls her pieces Hydra Medusa.
Hydra Medusa is the scientific name for jellyfish. One of the interesting things about jellyfish is that they're actually very simple, but what they are essentially are very thin layers of cells that are illuminated from within by their own phosphorescent elements. So in a way, these really are like jellyfish in the sense that the shells are the walls of cells and they are illuminated from within, and they really kind of work like jellyfish work. I think that people are really struck by this material, that they love the sound of them.
The luminous kapis shells from my childhood were taken down and put away years ago, probably because they seem dated or too delicate.
For me, in particular, it was so important because, like, these pieces that I have, I keep them for sentimental reasons. They're from my mother. They're really nice to look at. It's unique.
For Studio 360, I'm Jocelyn Gonzalez.
You can see some Capiz artwork on our website at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson, back out on the boardwalk, heading toward the beach with John Flansburgh and John Linnell of They Might Be Giants.
Listening to that story and thinking about people listening to, you know, peaceful summer sounds, and now that we're in the boom car Jeep environment of New York, it's kind
of a contrast. Not exactly the idyllic new age idea of beachdom.
No. Well, and it's, but we got a thumping bass.
We do have that. When I think of beach art, stuff made out of things on the beach, in addition to what I'm sure is your lovely Calder-esque sculpture of stones, I think of driftwood, and I never kind of got driftwood totally as a thing.
Yeah, it's sort of like Sammy Davis Jr. It can be an acquired taste.
You guys obviously are great, amazing craftspeople of pop music. Do you think of each song as a work of craft? Do you refine it? You're trying to push it? Or is it just the thing you do?
No, I think we really think of it as craft. I mean, when we started, we did a lot more improvisational stuff. And in the past few years, since we started working with a live band backing us up, we've kind of gotten back into that because we're more confident about it. But when we started, we kind of were doing a couple of different things, and there was an improvisational element, and then there was like a song structure element, and we just kind of made the decision at a certain point that the strong structure stuff worked a little bit better. It just allowed us to focus more. But, you know, you're constantly evolving as a songwriter, and you kind of can't... It would be nice to think you could just... if you simply did the same thing over and over again and kept on crafting similar ideas, you would just get better at it. But it doesn't... Unfortunately, it doesn't really work that way. I mean, you kind of have to... You have to keep on
setting up
evolving.
New challenges.
Yeah, yeah.
What are you up to now? What are you doing now?
Well, we actually are doing a children's a picture book for Simon & Schuster that's coming out this fall, and
so the children's media thing.
Yeah.
Is really,
well, it was kind of on the success of No, and you know, we're
No being the title of your children's record.
Yeah, No being the children's record.
Right. We discovered that with some of the material on No, which was kind of in the mold of like bedtime story music, or you know, sort of had this lyrical part that was like a lullaby, that it wasn't actually putting kids to sleep. In fact, it made them jumpy and they didn't want to go to bed. So we made this CD of a bunch of songs that comes with this book called Bed, 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 that actually are soporific. I can say that word on public radio.
You can. Yeah. Well, I was so impressed earlier hearing you sing a lyric in which you rhymed volleyball with folderall.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, there really is only one word for folderall, I guess. One rhyme.
Well, it's getting really, really hot. Too hot. The beach here at Coney Island is full. There are too many people with their shirts off, and I think it's probably time for us to...
I see the snake and parrot man is coming this way.
Oh, there's a man with two parrots on his back.
And a snake.
Well, it's an iguana, I think, more. Oh, and a snake as well.
Oh, I didn't see the iguana. Yeah.
Oh,
he's
God.
He's got a boa constrictor, an iguana, and two parrots.
He's
but
a walking jungle.
That doesn't seem to be what he's doing. He's taking pictures of people.
Well, I guess you get to, like, you can have your selection of whatever animal you want.
No, I think those are just the clothes
picture.
He normally wears, and he's in some completely different line of business. That's just what he put on this morning when he left the house.
John Linnell, John Flansburgh, thank you very, very much for playing
thanks.
For us and talking to us. We've got one more song from They Might Be Giants to close the show. What is it going to be?
This song is called Boat of Car. It's a special arrangement for a little wind group sung by Mr. John
That makes
Flansburgh.
No sense, Boat of Car. You know that, right?
Boat of Car. Well, make of it what you will.
Well, you can hear all of They Might Be Giants beach songs at studio360.org, along with all the stories we've ever done on the show. We want to thank today, before we hear They Might Be Giants play again, Dan Levine, Nathan Durham, Marty Beller, Mark Pender, Ed Haber, Irene Trudell, and Paul Ruest, and the staff of the Coney Island Museum. Thanks also to Lou Malazzi, the actor you heard in the story about the Village of the Mermaids. I'm Kurt Anderson, and this has been Studio 360.
Daddy sang bass. Daddy sang bass.
I took my boat for a car. I took that car for a ride. I was trying to get somewhere, but now I'm following the traces of your fingernails that run along the windshield on the boat of car.
Daddy sang bass.
Traces of your fingernails that run along the windshield on the boat of car. On the boat of
Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Lital Mulad,
David Krasnow,
Ave Carrillo,
Michelle Siegel,
Rob Weisberg,
Sarah Lilly,
Trent Wolby,
Sarah Nobles,
Megan Metcalf,
Andy Lancet.
Our theme music was composed by David Van Tiegum. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is a co-production of Public Radio International and WNYC New York, and is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, and by donors to PRI's Producers Forum, who include Dr. Claire Gaudiani and Christopher and Elizabeth Sullivan. Additional support provided by Audible.com, where members can download audio of this show, best-selling books, The New York Times, or other public radio programs at audible.com/studio360.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
Women can't go. Talking of Michelangelo.
T.S. Eliot as it ought to be.
The fact that Karen has this voice and doesn't realize how irritating it is amusing to me.
I'm Kurt Anderson. Join me and the Will and Grace star Megan Mullally next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.